Just thinking, this is the first time I've been here during a service since we've been showing the video, and I might possibly do announcements before the video, and that way the people taping know when to turn. How would you define a Christian? What are the basic requirements of being a Christian? Well, there are probably many ways to answer these questions, and I'm going to answer the first question right away and the second one throughout the sermon. And that first question, again, being, how would you define a Christian? And I said I would answer the question. Actually, Jesus Christ will answer the question. That's a lot safer than me answering the question. The answer is found in John 13, verse 35, which I think probably most of you are familiar with. John 13 and verse 35. Jesus said, "By this all will know that you are my disciples." And obviously a Christian is a follower of Christ, and so another way to put it is being a disciple of Christ. "By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." So that's a pretty simple definition, and yet a very comprehensive definition as well, when we consider what all that entails. Obviously more than what I have time to cover are there in the sermon today. We're all familiar also with the account in Matthew chapter 22, starting in verse 34, where some of the Pharisees ask him a question to try to put him on the spot. I'm going to read this from the New Living Translation and follow along in whatever version you have if you wish. Matthew chapter 22, starting in verse 34. "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees..." Now you have to understand, those were two not only religious groups, but basically political parties, in a sense, because they were involved even in the governance of the area that they lived in. So they basically disagreed on quite a number of things. And so it's very obvious here, good carnal reasoning, that he saw that, well, boy, he already put the Sadducees in their place. They should have realized if he could put the Sadducees in their place, he could probably do the same thing with them. But they didn't always think that well. So the account reads here, starting in verse 34, "When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees with his reply, they met together to question him again. One of them," verse 35, "an expert in religious law, tried to trap him with this question, 'Teacher, which is the most important commandment in the law of Moses?' Jesus replied, 'You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. A second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law and all the demands of the prophets are based on these two commandments.'" That's a pretty incredible statement, that everything that's written in the Old Testament is on the foundation of the principle of love. Love toward God, love toward fellow man. In other words, that's the bottom line of what it's all about. So once again, I mean, what Jesus said about being a Christian has to do with loving one another. And that particular aspect is what I want to focus on today throughout the sermon as far as Christianity. I mean, we could talk about loving God. That's a topic all in itself. I'm going to narrow it down to, it's still a very broad topic, which I'll narrow down even further, but we're going to talk primarily about loving our neighbor and loving our brother, which is the second greatest commandment. The question is, how do we go about this? I'm sure we all agree with this. I mean, we all realize, well, love is the most important thing there is. We all understand the scripture, I think, that, you know, loving God, loving fellow man. But where the rubber meets the road, I mean, how do we apply this? How do we show love to our fellow human beings? Let's look at Galatians 5, verses 13 through 15, first of all. Galatians chapter 5, verses 13 through 15. This I'll read in the New English Translation. Galatians 5, beginning of verse 13. Paul writes to the churches in Galatia, "For you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters." Freedom's a wonderful thing. That's a subject all in itself as well. I gave a sermon, you may recall, at Pentecost on "Are You Really Free?" But there are sometimes wrong concepts of freedom, even wrong uses of freedom. So Paul addresses us here and he says, "Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity to indulge your flesh." You know, there's some people, if they are free, they just go out and just are self-indulgent. And obviously, that's not love, right? So, I mean, the bottom line is love. Freedom is a wonderful quality, provided we use it to exercise love. not to just indulge ourselves. And obviously that was a problem in the churches of Galatia. It was a problem in the Gnostic-affected religions, which was one of the problems they were dealing with in the churches in Galatia. So it says, don't use your freedom as an opportunity to indulge your flesh, but through love, serve one another. For the whole law can be summed up in a single commandment, namely, you must love your neighbor as yourself. And of course, we just read that in Matthew's account of what Jesus himself said. However, if you continually bite and devour one another, beware that you are not consumed by one another. So that must have been a problem in the churches of Galatia as well, that there were people who were, you know, picking at each other and arguing and debating and that type of thing. And, you know, that's not what the Bible is written for. A lot of people use the Bible to argue over different things. You know, there's certain things that are controversial. I mean, we know that. We're dealing with a controversial issue right now in the church. But that doesn't mean we argue over it. That doesn't mean we fight over it. You know, I'm going to mention this. I don't have it in my notes, but I thought it was an interesting point. One of our elders is a medical doctor up in Canada. And the elders forum had been posting, of course, about the relocation issue for quite a while and probably will for quite a while yet. And one elder wrote in, he's an elder that grew up in England, and he used the term loyal opposition. Now, to the American mind, that's an oxymoron. What do you mean loyal opposition? How can you be against something and be loyal? Well, of course, it was batted around by other elders. Well, this elder posted something that was quite interesting. He said, you know, the church is likened to a body in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And we tend to think in our simplistic minds, well, what we want to learn is the head is the one that the brain makes all the decisions, the body just carries out the orders. Well, it really isn't that simple, actually, in a human body. I mean, there are actually some decisions that are not made in the brain. When you blink your eye, if something is going to hit you in the eye, if it had to go through your brain first, your eyelids couldn't act fast enough. There are some things that happen just instantaneously as reactions to the body. Well, anyway, he brought up something I guess I didn't know, maybe I did, but never thought about it, the spiritual connection. He said the way that our bodies are constructed, you have two sets of muscles. You have muscles that actually work against each other. You have your biceps and your, what are these called? Triceps. I was going to say that, but I didn't want to say the wrong thing. So, one works against the other for the harmony of the body, of all things. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting concept. The fact that, love is sometimes involved even in people having different viewpoints that they can contribute. You know, I remember saying one time many years ago in a congregation I was pastoring, if all we ever did was talk to people that agree with us, how would we ever learn anything? Right? It's something we need to learn how to do, to be able to discuss things with an open mind and be able to learn from each other. Okay, so I'll get back to my notes here. I don't want to get off the track here too far. So the point was here, what was happening in Galatia, I guess this is where I tracked off here, verse 15, so they were biting and devouring one another, and that's not love. You know, it's not love to fight and argue. To disagree and to, you know, listen to each other and try to learn from each other, that's a good thing. Thinking outside of the box, that's a good thing. But it all has to be based on love and serving and edifying one another. So let's take it one step further. I mean, that's still pretty conceptual. We're supposed to serve each other. Okay, well, fine, but, well, I agree with that. How do we do this? How are some of the ways the Bible says to serve each other? Obviously, there are many things we could come up with, but let's just look at a few that are mentioned in the Bible. James had a lot to say about that in his epistle, about basic Christianity. Read, first of all, from verses 22 through 25 of chapter 1. James chapter 1, verses 22 through 25. I'm going to read this in New Living once again. Because we've heard it so many times in King James, sometimes hearing a different translation, maybe you'll pick something up that you might not otherwise have heard before. It talks in the New King James and Old King James about not just being hearers, but also being doers. New Living says, don't just listen to God's word. You must do what it says. Otherwise, you're only fooling yourselves. For if you listen to the word and don't obey, it's like glancing at your face in a mirror. You see yourself, walk away, and forget what you look like. But if you look carefully into the perfect law that sets you free, and if you do what it says and don't forget what you heard, then God will bless you for doing it. So, you know, we're going to be hearing today some things about what the Bible says about what it means to be a Christian, what it means to show love, what it means to serve each other. And I hope everybody will listen all the way through. But that's not enough. It says we have to put it into practice. Otherwise, you know, you go home or even after services, you know, maybe you get to talking about something else and forget what the sermon is about before you ever leave the building. Doesn't do you any good, does it? Just to hear it and then, like, glancing at your face, and, oh, I got something on the side of my face. I better go get a napkin, and the phone rings. So you answer the phone, you forget to get the napkin, and your face has still got stuff on it, right? Well, that's one thing with something on your face. It's something else again if it's something in our lives that needs to be corrected, obviously. So James gives an example. Go forward about another chapter in chapter 2 and verse 15. Proving the point that just listening and even saying something is not necessarily enough. Again, in the New Living Translation, verse 15, James chapter 2. Suppose you see a brother or sister who has no food or clothing. And you say, goodbye, have a good day, stay warm and eat well. But then you don't give that person any food or clothing. What good does that do? So you see, faith by itself isn't enough. Unless it produces good deeds, it is dead and useless. So, you know, again, you can say, well, boy, you know, I really love this person. I'm concerned for him. I'm praying for him. But if you have capacity to help and you don't do it, see? I mean, I think the point's pretty obvious. I don't have to elaborate. It's very clear, the point that's being made. I'd say we've done pretty good on this one, as evidenced by our response to the local Katrina victims some time back and the food bank donations we make at the feast every year. That's a good thing. You know, we actually are helping needy people by doing this. Of course, on the other hand, in the case of Katrina in particular, many, if not most, of the items we donated were extra things we didn't really need anyway. So that wasn't really difficult to do that. I mean, some people may have sacrificed and given things that you really needed, and I don't mean to demean that whatsoever. But I've heard it said, and I think it's very true, that sometimes the easiest way to help is simply to write a check. And just write a check, send it off, and, okay, I've done my good deed. That's, I mean, if you don't have the money, it's hard, but everybody has a little extra money. You can, you know, write off a check or open up your billfold, throw in a dollar bill or a $5 bill or something like that. But it really has to go further than that. It's especially even easier at the feast to donate to the local food bank because we have second tithe. Most of us do, not everybody, but most of us do. And it's pretty easy to pull out a $20 bill even and put it in there. And that's, I don't mean to demean that once again. I'm glad we do that. But it's one of the easiest things, one of the easiest ways to do this. It gets a little more difficult as we go through other scriptures, even here staying in the book of James. James 1 and verse 27. James 1 and verse 27. I'll read this in the New King James. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this. So here's the Bible definition of, okay, this is, if you want to come up with something that's really basic, what Christianity is really about, here's what it says. To visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. I would venture to say that probably most of us have emphasized that first part of this verse a whole lot more than the second part, wouldn't you say? That we are very concerned about keeping ourselves unspotted from the world, especially this time of the year when Christmas is all around. We don't want to get involved in that, you know, and we don't want to get involved in other wrong things. And that's all well and good, but how much emphasis have we put, just all of us taking this personally, of visiting orphans and widows in their trouble? Not just orphans and widows, but in principle, anyone who has needs or going through difficulties. Now, let me explain something about the word visit, because we use the word visit in two ways. Either go to somebody's house and see them in person, or visiting after services, which means talking to each other. The word actually means far more than that in the Greek language. It comes from two words. I'll get a little technical here. Epi and skopeo. Epi means upon, and skopeo is where we get the word scope, like microscope, telescope. It means to look over or to oversee, all right? So let me give you a definition here of what the word means in one of the lexicons. To care for or look after with the implication of continuous responsibility. So it's not just going to see somebody. It's not just talking to somebody. It's actually overseeing a situation of looking out for someone Now, I guess that's where the word skopeo comes in the picture. Look after someone. We use that even in our English language. To feel a personal responsibility, in other words, to help people in need. And to take that, as it says here, is a implication of a continuous responsibility. This is a very important part of Christianity that I would say probably most of us neglect more than we should. I'm very thankful. I've thought this for many, many years. One of the reasons I'm thankful to be a paid pastor is because I'm being paid to do something I should do anyway. You know, and that's to visit people in need. I hope I would do that anyway. I mean, I don't know because I get paid to do it. It's part of my job. So I'm glad I have that, you know, that responsibility that's given to me. But according to the Bible, you know, whether we're paid to do it or not, it's part of a basic part of our responsibility as Christians is to look after people who are in need, as we have, of course, the opportunity to do so. There are many ways to do this. I mean, depending on our circumstances. Let me throw in a scripture here, which I don't have in my notes while I'm thinking about it. In Galatians 6, I think, in verse 16, because this is not Galatians 6, verse 9, I'm sorry. This is not a one-size-fits-all that we can all apply to the same degree. Maybe it is 16. Thinking at, let's see here. Should have looked it up before services. I mentioned it to somebody beforehand. Verse 10, I'm sorry. Galatians 6, verse 10. So just erase that little curly Q at the top there. Make your 6 into a 0. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. That says a lot. It says, first of all, there are priorities. In other words, that we need to concentrate even more on our brethren, obviously, than we do people who are not brethren. Not that we're any better than anybody else, but just like you would in your physical family, human family, you would tend to help people in your family, make sure they're taken care of before you go out and help somebody not in the family. And the same thing is true spiritually in our spiritual family. We would be more concerned about helping people in our spiritual family before we would go out and help other people that are not part of the church. Because we all have limitations. You have only so much time, so much money. And the priority is you help people in, you know, that are brethren before you help somebody who are not. And that is the second point that's mentioned in the beginning part of the verse. As we have opportunity, let us do good. And that emphasizes the fact that some people have more opportunity than others. Some people have more spare money than others. Some people say, what's spare money? I don't have any spare money. Or same thing with time. You know, some people have more time. Some people work, you know, long hours or maybe two jobs or husband and wife both work. Others of you retired have more time, probably more time, less money, you know. People have more money have less time. So, I mean, some people have more of one, some people have more of another. But once again, see, what do we do with that time? What do we do with that money? Well, it's, again, based on the principle of serving one another. So a lot of ways you can fulfill this and still not say, well, I don't have enough money, don't have enough time. You probably have some of one or both that you can spend, at least occasionally, to fulfill this aspect here of looking out for people who are in need. One thing it's nice to do is literally to actually go visit them. Go and see them in person. Give them a call and say, you know, I thought about coming over to see you. Especially people maybe who aren't able to attend services. If you're not able to do that, you can give them a call. Send them an email. Send them a card. Cards are pretty inexpensive. You can get them for $2, $3, $4, even less. There's a place here in town, I think, where you can get them for, what, I don't know, $1? 59 cents. There you go, see? My Scottishness is rubbing off now. 59 cents, yeah. Just blot out the price and send it, right? No, you know the old saying, it's the thought that counts, right? That's what counts. Of course, what it says is important, too. It's more than just orphans and widows. There are other needy people as well. Members going through severe trials. We know of that here, don't we? We know there are people right here today that are going through severe trials. Someone who hasn't been to services for a while. Or even one Sabbath. You know, a good thing to do if someone misses, if part of the family doesn't come to something, What are you doing? You have concern for them. Well, I wonder if they're sick. You give them a call and say, well, I missed you today. I know we tend to think, well, I don't want to make it look like I'm prying or anything like that. That's one extreme. The other extreme is if you don't call and people miss for 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks or more and nobody calls them, they think, does anybody care about me? Well, of course we do, don't we? But if you don't express it, how does that person know? So take the risk, you know, take the risk. Go ahead and call and say, we've missed you. I hope you're doing okay. And that's part of this thing of looking out for people. That's a basic aspect of being a Christian. There are some people who aren't able to attend at all. They're physically not able to. I'm not going to mention any names here in the sermon because I don't know who all might hear this, but I'll give you the names afterwards, after services, and addresses and contact information. One of them is Tom's brother. I just saw him this past week. And he is setting a Guinness Book of World Records for survival for Lou Gehrig's disease. You know, his hands are crippled, his knees are crippled, he can't walk, he can't stand, but his mind is fine. And he loves carrying on a conversation, he's very zealous in the study of the Bible, and he's in a care center. Fran can tell you, Carol can tell you, of course, Tom as well. And I have the information, contact information. He would love to see you, I know he would. I didn't ask him, I didn't have to. But I hope some of you will give him a call once in a while and maybe go see him or just talk to him on the phone. Send him a card or something. He considers himself a member of the congregation. He prays for us. He told me when I was over there Thursday, he said, I pray for your family all the time. And, of course, I told him I pray for him too. But, you know, it's important to show it, show your love by doing tangible things for people like this. Another one is Bill. Over in Burns. And I'll give you his information. Now, if you don't know him, you know, you might want to send him a card. But he misses everybody. He prays for everybody. He calls me quite often. If I don't call him enough, he calls me. I go see him about once every 4 to 6 weeks and everything. But the first thing he always asks, so how is everybody doing? And he always asks about certain specific people and things, you know. And he's a good-hearted guy overall. He's a character. He'd be the first one to tell you that. But that's why I say if you don't know him, that's one thing. But he misses people. He can't come to services. He's legally blind. He has other problems, you know, that would not make it possible for him to attend. But he's stuck off all by himself over there, 130 miles away. And he's constantly thinking about people. He's asking constantly, are there anybody that needs to be prayed for, you know? So I have information for him as well. That's a big, big area, and you have no idea how important it is unless you've been on the receiving end of something like that. You know, when you're healthy and happy and things are going relatively well for you and you're able to come to church every week, you know, we're all busy enough. We sometimes don't tend to think about some of these people that just fall through the cracks. That's part of basic Christianity, is to remember those people. We know who they are. We should know who they are. And we need to make sure that we're spending a certain amount of time and money to oversee these people and to show care and express concern and love. It's one thing to have the love, but if you don't express it, it doesn't do a lot of good. It's just like the Bible itself. If you know it, you hear it, and don't do it, it doesn't do any good just to have it if you don't use it. You know, love is something that you don't just keep to yourself. Love is something that has to be exercised and used to serve people once again. Let's take it one step further. It's still in the book of James, verses 8 and 9 of chapter 2. Now, I bet you, most of you aren't even aware of the fact that you may be guilty of what this warns not to do. Let's read what it says. In the New King James still, James 2, verses 8 and 9, if you really fulfill the royal law, and it does say really, so that kind of tells you something too. If you really fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well. So it kind of implies that some people may think they're doing this, but they're really not the way it should be done. And here's what it goes on to say in verse 9. But if you show partiality you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. Could you be guilty of showing partiality in some of these things we've been talking about? Maybe you don't realize how you do. Before I answer that question, let's read another scripture in Luke 14, verse 12 through 14. Read this in a translation that's Holman's Christian Study Bible. I've never quoted that before, but this had the best rendition of this that I could find. Luke 14, verses 12 through 14. We know that I've already talked about that, you know, about visiting people, and the other aspect is inviting people over to your home. Now, I know some of you don't have a big enough place to entertain, or maybe don't have whatever other reasons might be limit you in that way. But a lot of us, most of us probably have the opportunity to do that, to have people over. You know, the Bible actually addresses this subject, how to do this. You might think, well, what's the difference? You know, if I have somebody over, I mean, isn't that good enough? Well, let's read what it says here. Starting verse 12, Luke 14. He also said to the one who had invited him, when you give a lunch or dinner, don't invite your friends, your brothers, your relatives, or your rich neighbors, because they might invite you back and you would be repaid. On the contrary, when you host a banquet, invite those who are poor, maimed, lame, or blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Now, what is this getting at? Well, I'm going to glean a principle from this. Ask you the question, what are your criteria for inviting people over for dinner, if you're able to do that? Do you assume that some could not or would not come because their mate isn't a church member, or because they're single, or too young, or too old to feel comfortable with the other people you invite over? Probably all of us have been guilty of that. We think, oh, I can't invite that person because their mate's not in the church, and so they wouldn't be able to come. Or, well, I'm just having married couples over, and this person is single, and they'd probably feel uncomfortable. Or I'm inviting all older people, so this person has a preteen or teenagers, so they wouldn't feel comfortable. Well, what's the problem here? You're showing partiality, and furthermore, you're making a decision for that person. You're assuming that person couldn't come or wouldn't want to come. Did it ever occur to you to ask them, would you like to come? Now, you know, we're not having any others over your age, or if you want to qualify that, you can. But just ask. Just ask. And furthermore, if this is someone who's going through some severe trials, I'm going to tell you, as one who have been through severe trials, as most of you have, when you're going through a severe trial, your tentacles are out there. And you pick up on things, and you're very sensitive. And it's very easy to feel hurt, to feel left out, to feel unloved. I know, because I've been there. At other times, you know, you don't think a thing about things. But when you're really hurting and in need of love and personal contact and things like this, it's very easy to feel left out, even offended. And, you know, it's nobody would ever, if they just realized, would ever want to do that. But sometimes, brethren, you know what? We just don't think. We just don't think. We're all busy. We all have busy lives, or most of us do anyway. And sometimes we don't just stop and think, well, let's see now. How would so-and-so react to this? Oh, I wonder what they're going through. How are they reacting? Or just kind of think twice about it, you know. Just think a little bit more. But all you have to do in a situation like this is just ask the person. If they don't want to come, hey, then they can tell you. But if they don't get a chance to do it, you know, then you can see how that could really hurt someone's feelings. Some of these things are inevitable. I know I've been in situations like this. I'm sure all of you have, where you're with a group of people. I mean, this has happened with fellow ministers. And, you know, at a conference or something, and someone's inviting someone else, well, let's go out to dinner together. And I'm standing there, or somebody else is standing there. You don't get asked. Or you say, oh, you can come too if you want to, or something, you know. That doesn't feel good. You know, I know that personal experience, and probably a lot of you have had that, have been on the receiving end of that. So just stop and think about that. It's, again, part of basic Christianity, showing love and serving each other, because there are some people who need it even more than others. So let's just be sure that we're not showing partiality and just having people over, you know, that we think that would want to come or would have a good time, or people that are the life of the party. So I want to have a good time, so I'm going to have so-and-so over, and this person's quiet, so I don't want to have them over because, you know, it could be difficult or whatever. Again, what is our motive? Is our motive to serve, or is it just something to have a good time? It's fine to have a good time, have people over to have a good time, but don't say I'm doing this great Christian deed if that's all you're doing is just having someone over that you hit it off with and, you know, just to have a good time. But if you invite people that are needy, that's something else again, and that's really what the Bible is telling us that we need to do. Well, how important is this? I mean, is this just something relatively minor, or isn't it pretty basic, major aspect of what God's way of life is all about? Well, again, I can answer this if we could turn to Matthew chapter 25. Because, you know, we tend to think about, I could have asked the question at the beginning of the sermon, and a lot of you would have embarrassed yourself by giving answers that I wasn't looking for about how you define a basic Christian, a basic Christianity, or what a Christian is, or what a Christian is supposed to do. But, you know, you really can't get much more basic than this when it gets down to the point of separating a sheep from the goats. Who's a true Christian, who isn't? Because the first thing we tend to think about is, well, you got to keep Sabbath, you got to have the true doctrines, you got to do this, you got to do that, and all those are important, yes, but look at what it says here. And we're very familiar with this, let's read it anyway. Starting in verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand and the goats on the left. What are the criteria? Is it doctrinal? Well, not really. I mean, it's doctrinal in the sense that doctrine simply means teaching, but look what it involves. And, of course, we already know. We're probably familiar with the section. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. That's that same Greek word. Doesn't mean just to go see the person, although that certainly can and oftentimes is included, but it means you looked after the person, like the Good Samaritan in the other parable. I was in prison, and you came to me. Now, I know there are qualifying factors to all of these things. There was an article, I kind of wish now I had cut it out, maybe some of you saw it, in the Ben newspaper about dealing with what they call panhandlers that are saying, you know, the last one I saw is anything will help, God bless. They always say God bless at the end. They don't say God bless you, they say God bless. I don't know where they get that. But this article was saying that most of these individuals are actually alcoholics or druggies looking for something to feed their addiction. This particular article offered business cards that had a listing of where people can get free meals and where they can spend the night. And this person suggested give them one of these cards, you know, because they can go there to get a free meal. They can go there to stay overnight. So, I mean, they're qualifying factors. And this is not saying that, you know, you need to go out and give money to everybody that's begging for money. But it's legitimate needs. And certainly, once again, especially within the church family itself, but also other people as well, as we brought out in Galatians 6:10. Verse 37, then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Then he also will say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Now, you think, for what reason? You think all these so-called sin lists, you know, about adulterers and whoremongers and idolaters and liars, that kind of thing. I mean, look at these people. These are people who simply didn't do that. They are cursed. For what reason? For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they also will answer him, saying, well, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of these least of these, you did not do it to me. and these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Now, we're all familiar with that parable. I wouldn't even have to read it. You know the point in here. But have we considered how important this is? We're talking about something that separates people from living for eternity with God versus people who are thrown in the lake of fire. You know, I mean, I don't know to what degree here, but obviously it says that people who don't ever do this, they're kidding themselves. They're not really a true Christian, because being a true Christian is having love and serving each other. And these are people who simply did not do that. So really, you know, I said I was going to concentrate on showing love toward our fellow human beings, but according to this parable, serving and helping brethren in need is not just how we love fellow human beings, it's also an expression of love for God. Isn't that what Jesus said? Inasmuch as you've done it unto these, the least of them, you've done it to me. And if you don't do it to them, you haven't done it to me. So if we don't love people who are in need and show that love, Christ takes it personally, says, you're not loving me either. Because you really can't separate the two. You know, loving God involves loving fellow human beings as well, and this certainly makes that very clear. So how can we examine ourselves to see how truly religious or Christian we really are? Let's look at some points on that before we finish. 1 John 3 and verse 16, one principle given here. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16, I'm going to read this again from the New Living Translation and give you a little time to get there in your translation that you have. 1 John 3, verse 16, we know what real love is because Jesus gave up his life for us. So we also ought to give up our lives for our brothers and sisters. What does this mean? Well, we think, obviously, Jesus literally gave up his life in the sense he died for us. And the literal meaning is we need to be willing to even die for someone else, if that came down to that. But laying down or giving up our lives for our brethren doesn't mean just being willing to die for them. Because our life consists of what? Consists of time, right? So the question is, are we willing to spend time to serve others? That's a way of laying down our lives or giving up part of our lives to serve others. It means having to give up something else you might have planned to do. You know, we can all say I'm too busy. But you know, I mean, you've heard this before, there isn't any one of us in this room that has 1 minute or second more time than anyone else. We all have 24 hours a day. It's a question of what are our priorities. You know, how do we determine what we do? How much time we spend on various things? Now, granted, some have more time to give than others. I mean, you can't obviously take off work and go do something. If you work long hours, as I said earlier, you don't have as much time as people who maybe are retired. Same thing is true with money, of course. But a few of us have so much spare time, we don't know what to do. I don't have that problem, but maybe some of you do. You got so much spare time, you don't know what to do. Well, I've already given you a lot of good suggestions here how to spend some of that spare time. Like I said, some of us wonder, what is spare time, you know? But all of us have a little bit of time we can devote. There are ways to do these things, you know, and still be able to not have to take time that we really don't have. Let me give you a quote here from Daily Study Bible to kind of emphasize this point here about laying down our lives and how that we can do it other ways other than just being, you know, put to death for the sake of someone else. Barclay says, a man may say, how can I follow in the steps of Christ? He laid down his life upon the cross. You say I ought to lay down my life for the brothers. But opportunities so dramatic as that don't come into my life. What then? John's answer is true, but when you see your brother in need and you have enough to give him out of what you have is to follow Christ. Let me emphasize again, but when you see your brother in need and you have enough, in other words, your needs are taken care of, you probably got some extra, says to give to him what you have is to follow Christ. To shut your heart and to refuse to give is to show that the love of God, which is in Jesus Christ, has no place in you. John insists that we can find plenty of opportunities to show forth the love of Christ in the life of the everyday. Thus, it may call for the simple expenditure of money we might have spent upon ourselves to relieve the need of someone poorer. It is, after all, the same principle of action, though at a lower level of intensity. It's the willingness to surrender that which has value for our own life to enrich the life of another. If such a minimum response to the law of charity called for by such everyday situations is absent, then it's idle to pretend that we are within the family of God, the realm in which love is operative as the principle and token of eternal life. Pretty well stated, wouldn't you say? Let's look at another scripture in Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, we'll begin in verse 13. So many times Jesus would take an incident that occurred during his ministry to bring a lesson from it of how we ought to live our lives. In this particular case, verse 13 tells us, then one from the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." You know, Christ had all the answers to everything. Here was a guy who had a money problem. There's an argument in there regarding inheritance. You know, that program I used to watch, Touched by an Angel, Tess had a line that I thought was humorous and so very true. Wherever there's a will, there's always somebody in the way. Well, here's an example here of a disagreement over inheritance. "Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And the lesson here is, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?' So he said, 'I'll do this. I'll pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' Boy, God is blessing me so much. I'm able to get these buildings, all this money. I got it made, kick back, take it easy, enjoy it. And I'll say, but God said to him, 'You fool, this night your soul or your life will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself is not rich toward God.'" Let me share with you Barclay's comments on this. He said it was not uncommon for people in Palestine to take their unsettled disputes to respected rabbis. But Jesus refused to be mixed up in anyone's disputes about money. But out of that request, there came to Jesus an opportunity to lay down what his followers' attitude to material things should be. He had something to say both to those who had an abundant supply of material possessions and to those who had not. To those who had an abundant supply of possessions, Jesus spoke this parable of the rich fool. Two things stand out about this man. A, he never saw beyond himself. There is no parable which is so full of the words I, me, my, mine. A schoolboy was once asked what parts of speech my and mine are. He answered, aggressive pronouns. Aggressive pronouns. The rich fool was aggressively self-centered. It was said of a self-centered young lady, Edith lived in a world bounded on the north, south, east, and west by Edith. The famous criticism was made of a self-centered person. There is too much ego in his cosmos. When this man had a superfluity of goods, too many goods, the one thing that never entered his head was to give any away. His whole attitude was the very reverse of Christianity. Instead of denying himself, he aggressively affirmed himself. Instead of finding his happiness in giving, he tried to conserve it by keeping. The Romans had a proverb which said that money was like seawater. The more a man drank, the thirstier he became. And so long as a man's attitude is that of the rich fool, his desire will always be to get more. And that's the reverse of the Christian way. B, he never saw beyond this world. All his plans were made on the basis of life here. There is a story of a conversation between a young and ambitious lad and an older man who knew life. Said the young man, "I will learn my trade." "And then?" said the older man. "I will set up business." "And then?" "I'll make my fortune." "And then?" "I suppose that I shall grow old and retire and live on my money." "And then?" "Well, I suppose that someday I will die." "And then?" came the stabbing question. The man who never remembers that there is another world is destined someday for the grimmest. Give alms. Provide yourselves money bags which do not grow old, a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Now let me clarify, this does not mean you should go home, sell everything you got, and go live in a tent so you can give to the poor. I mean, just look at it logically. I mean, if you did that, can you imagine? How could the whole world become Christian? You gave to some poor person. I don't want that stuff. I want to be a Christian. It's really talking about, look, at we all have things we really don't need. So if we don't have extra money, be willing to sell something and use that money to help somebody has need. Now, once again, we do this. We do a good job on this. We have our annual church garage sale to finance needy brethren in Peru attending the feast. It's a prime example of how we can apply this. You know, we still got that jar back there, by the way, too, to donate. And, you know, we still take the printer cartridges. Those are easy things to do. But it takes some thought. You know, it takes a little bit of extra effort. Just to be able to maybe, if we don't have extra money, say, well, you know, I don't really need this. I'll sell this and use this money to help the needy. You know, the Mormon Church has an interesting program. One meal a month, I think it is, they fast. And they take the money it would cost that meal and contribute to the poor. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. That's basic Christianity in action. This shows how this can be done. Luke 3, verse 11, back up a few chapters. Similar point is mentioned over here. Luke 3, verse 11. This is from John the Baptist in this case. He was asked by some of the people, so what are we supposed to do, you know, to show our repentance? His answer was, if you have two shirts, give one to the poor. If you have food, share it with those who are hungry. Now, let me explain. In the Jewish language, see, we read things, we take it literally. You know, it says, pluck out your eyes. We don't understand it. Why would you want to pluck out your eyes or cut off your arm if it offends you? This is a figure of speech that means if you have an extra amount of something, take some of that and share with somebody who doesn't have any. It doesn't literally mean if you only got two coats, they say, well, I got to give up one of these to somebody who doesn't have a coat. If it came down to it, you know, if there was someone who didn't have it, and you had one extra, yeah, I guess it would come to that. So I'm not saying it's wrong to do that. I'm just saying the principle here is if you have more than enough, you need to be willing to share it with people who don't have enough. Not just willing, but you actually need to do it. But I'm going to give you an example I will never forget in my life. There was a lady in another congregation I pastored years ago that I was visiting, and I made known to her someone in the congregation in the area there that had a need for a kitchen knife, you know, these big, long kitchen knives. She went in her kitchen, opened up her drawer, looked down in the drawer. I was standing right there. There were two knives in her drawer. She had a very big family. Her husband wasn't in the church. She didn't have a lot of money and things. She hesitated for probably 1 second, picked up one of those knives, says, give this to her. And it put me to shame. How many knives did I have in my drawer at home? This lady had two. She gave one of them up. With a momentary hesitation, 1 second, literally 1 second, she looked down there, grabbed it, gave it to me. I'll never forget that. That's Christianity in action, I'm telling you. I have never seen a better example than that. 1 John 3, verse 17, in the New Living Translation. 1 John 3 and verse 17. Still on the same subject here. If someone has enough money to live well and sees a brother or sister in need but shows no compassion, how can God's love be in that person? Rhetorical question, a very good one, isn't it? Verse 18, dear children, let's not merely say we love each other. Let us show the truth by our actions. Our actions will show that we belong to the truth so that we will be confident when we stand before God. You know, I don't want to have to be ashamed and have to make excuses. I've done it before, and it's embarrassing and it's shameful to have to make an excuse and have to admit, you know, I'm sorry, I dropped the ball on this. I didn't do as I should. So I'm not giving you this saying I'm some great spiritual giant that's doing all these things perfect, because I'm not. But I'm just telling you what the book says. You know, this is what basic Christianity is about. You can boil it down to a simple one-sentence formula. It's in Luke 12, and verse 34. Luke 12 and verse 34. This is a acid test. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. That's what it's telling us. I mean, where our treasure is, there our heart will be also. That's after that we read earlier, verse 33, where it talks about selling to things to be able to help people in need. The word treasure, interestingly, doesn't just mean we think of treasure, we think of like gold and silver and stuff like that. This word in the Greek can also refer to a treasure box or a repository or a place where you put your money. So the question is, where do you put your money? Especially if you have extra money. That's a test of your religion, where you spend your money. That includes, by the way, second tithe at the feast. You know, we have a lot of extra money at the feast. Do we just use that to indulge ourselves? Now, granted, the Bible says, buy whatever your soul desires. Let's look up, though, Deuteronomy 14 and see what it says. Because it says more than that. It's fine. That's one time of the year when we can indulge ourselves and buy whatever we like. But it doesn't end with that. Because not everybody has second tithe to be able to indulge themselves. And they deserve to be able to learn the blessings of God's way of life as well, even though they don't have the funds to be able to do so. We know the instructions starting in verse 22 about tithing the increase and eating before the Lord, verse 23. That would be the actual tithe itself of produce and what have you. But it mentions the possibility there, the option which in the culture we live in, we exercise today. And that is, it says to verse 25, we can exchange the actual produce or whatever it is, tithe money instead, which most of us do since we're on the monetary standard. Take the money in your hand and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses. You should spend that money for whatever your heart desires. We know this one real well. For oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God. You shall rejoice, you and your household, first of all. So it's for the whole family. And, of course, most of us understand and apply that. But notice verse 27. You shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you. Now, we don't have Levites today. And I'm not implying that ministers are Levites, because we're not. I mean, there's some similarities, but there are a lot of differences. For one thing, we're paid a salary. You know, I own property. Levites didn't. The principle here is a needy person. Remember the needy person, to help them to rejoice as well. So some of our second tithe should be used to help somebody who's needy. Invite them out for a meal. Do something to help them to enjoy the feast as well. And as we know, the next verse talks about in the culture at that time in ancient Israel, they had a whole year where everybody took everything they had and contributed to the poor. That's what it says in verse 29. Some scholars can't believe this could actually be done, or it was done. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gate. I'm sorry, start at verse 28. At the end of the third year, you shall bring forth the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. So as we're talking about different funding here. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the stranger, the fatherless, the widow who are within your gates, may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. Well, I wish we could do that today. You know, we live in a culture where, you know, the whole nation is not on the same standard these people were. They actually, I can imagine how people, you know, Acts 20:35 says more blessed to give than to receive. Can you imagine a person with a giving attitude, how they'd look forward to storing up all this money, and at this third year, open the door and invite people in and really treat them to a wonderful feed, you know, different people all the time and things. That's what this is saying. People who are needy, that don't have, like the Levites and others that are poor, that don't have the means to take care of themselves. Well, in our culture today, we have public assistance. We have Social Security and other public assistance. And our decision, I call it doctrinal, administrative, whatever you wish, is that this needs to be factored into this third tithe thing, that we actually are contributing to the needy by the money that's taken out of our paycheck. We don't see it goes to Social Security and other means. And that's all well and good. And you can say, well, technically, we're not maybe liable in the same way that people were at that time. But you know what? You can ask people in this room probably how sufficient is public assistance and taking care of needs. Don't get me off on that tangent. It's one of my pet peeves. I mean, it's great that we have it, but believe me, a lot of people still fall through the cracks. My wife's brother Don is a prime example. He's been turned down twice for Social Security, a disability. And the guy is, you know, he's living on borrowed time. He's turned down twice. Something to pray about too, obviously, but the point is that there are still needy people in the church and outside the church as well. And of course, the priority, again, the Bible says in Galatians 6, is for people in the church is our first priority. But the point is the need is still there. So don't say, well, I'm off the hook in this. I don't have to contribute to the needy because I'm, you know, have money out of my check to go to Social Security. If the need is there and you're able to help, you better do it. I don't care whether it's a technical requirement or not. I mean, the requirement is a requirement of love. So that's another thing. Luke 12:34, where is your treasure? Where do you put your money? That's a good determination of how genuine our Christianity is. One more test. Matthew 12:34. We read Luke 12:34. This one is Matthew 12:34. Just going to read part of it here that illustrates the point. I'm going to read it from four different translations. And in a different context, what is presented here in the Bible, because it's talking about a bad example, but the principle still applies in good examples as well. Matthew 12:34, New King James, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. I want to be sure we understand what that means. The International Version says, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. The way I like to illustrate this, I have this bottle of water here. If I were to open this up and bring a pitcher up here or put it under that water fountain, which is hidden underneath there, and turn on the spigot, what would happen? What would happen? The water would spill out, right? Spill over the top. So what this is telling us is what comes out of the mouth is what fills the heart. If we are putting a lot of stuff into the heart, it's going to spill out the mouth. In fact, the New English translation says, the mouth speaks from what fills the heart. New Living Translation says, whatever is in your heart determines what you say. So what we say, what we talk about, determines where our heart is, right? We talk about something that's in our hearts. It's not just mine, I hope not. It's what's in our heart as well. So that's a good test. What do we talk about? You know, we talk about, and this applies throughout every day of our lives, including after services. We use the term fellowshipping after services. We're all familiar with that. It means to sit around and talk with each other. What do we talk about? Good question. Is fellowship just talking about things you would talk about with anybody out in the street? Or is there more to it then? Is there more to fellowship than that? Let's look at 1 John 1, verse 3. 1 John 1 and verse 3. John writes here, and this is New Living Translation again. We proclaim to you what we ourselves have actually seen and heard so that you may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We are writing these things so that you may fully share our joy. Fellowship means sharing. That's what the word actually means in the Greek. It means sharing. That we can share with each other by giving things, we can share with each other by talking about things. We need to realize that as Christians, our fellowship, our sharing is on a higher level than it is with other people who don't have this hope. I'm sure all of you have been to family reunions. I know back in my hometown, I remember as a kid, I was so just turned off and bored by family reunions. All people would do would be talk about their operations. You know? I said, ugh, here we go again. And, you know, on the job, people talk about these things. You think, ugh, what does that have to do? Well, you know, it's saying here, our fellowship is with the Father and with Jesus Christ. Spiritual fellowship involves, guess what? Spiritual items. Everything is in a spiritual focus. It doesn't mean to say that we just talk about, you know, the Bible and nothing else. We talk about things from a spiritual perspective. But do we talk about the Bible? Do we talk about God's blessings? Do we talk about answered prayers? I think some people think, oh, that would be Protestant to do that. You know, the Protestants do some good things once in a while. called testimonials. Testimonials are wonderful things. I mean, if you've had some blessing in your life, hey, share it with people. You know, it can be very encouraging to people. So what's in your heart? Well, what do you talk about? It's a good test. What have you been thinking about during the week? Have you been studying the Bible? If you haven't been putting anything in your heart, you're not going to have anything to share. You're going to have to be mechanical. Oh, I got to talk about that. See what I want to talk about. Shouldn't be that way. That even says back in Deuteronomy 6, you know, when you teach your children, but you talk about things as well. You don't just teach them formally, you talk about it. Let's go back there because it's another very important principle with regard to that. There's a prerequisite even in how we teach our children. And it's what we've been talking about here in Matthew 12, 34. Matthew 6, verse 7 is where it says you teach them, you know, these. Well, first of all, let's read verse 5. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Verse 7 says you should teach these things to your children diligently. And talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. What's the prerequisite? Well, first of all, it says you have to love God with all your heart. That's the first great commandment. And verse 6 says, these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. If they aren't in your heart, you're going to come across your kids as a phony. You know, Solomon told his kids, beware of strange women. He didn't follow his own advice. What kind of credibility does he have? You know? You have to love God, first of all. The words have to be in your heart. Then you're automatically going to talk about them based on Matthew 12, 34. What's in your heart determines what you say. The mouth speaks and what fills the heart. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Good question. You know, I've heard people say, I've heard this recently, why don't more people talk about sermon, about the work, about different things like that? Good question. I don't want to interfere here and make people get paranoid and think I'm going to be listening to what you're talking about, but I'm just saying, you know, maybe we need to think about, are we really in need of upgrading what we talk about? It starts back before that, of making sure that our heart is filled with the things that we need to be filled with, so that we can automatically just talk about more things along that line. Well, what does that have to do with loving each other? I mean, what you talk about, isn't that just about you? No, it isn't. James 1, verse 26, back to good old James again, here's another thing to say about this, about what we talk about. He says, verse 26, chapter 1, if you claim to be religious but don't control your tongue, you're fooling yourself and your religion is worthless. Boy, that's a strong one, isn't it? If you stop and think about it, things we say can make a big difference with other people, can't they? It's not just about us, it's about other people. What we say does affect other people. This is New Living Translation again. If you claim to be religious but don't control your tongue, you are fooling yourself and your religion is worthless. Because religion involves not just you and God, but it also involves how you affect other people, if you're loving and serving other people. On the positive side of the ledger, Colossians 4, 6, New English Translation has this to say. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you should answer someone. Dick Thompson made an interesting comment at the regional conference. I love him. He's such a what you see is what you get person. And I think he was kind of tired at the time when he said this. He said, you know, I find out when I'm tired. He said, I'm like, Wile E. Coyote? He says, is that right? I don't watch the cartoon. But yeah, Wile E. Coyote. He says he's always shooting the guns out before he gets them out of his holster. You know, I mean, all sometimes do this. So we shoot off our mouth before we pull the gun out of the holster, before we think first, you know. Very important to consider what we say before we say something, because, you know, it says so we may know how to answer everyone, that it needs to be gracious and seasoned with salt. You know, just fire from the hip, you know. Wyatt Earp said it's not how fast you are in the draw, it's how accurate you are that counts. And he lived to tell about it, you know. He died of with his boots on. Or boots off, I should say, died in, anyway, lived a normal life. Certainly true with regard to what we say. You know what I mean, anyway. It's getting late in the sermon. My brain's giving out. My voice and brain both. So it does what we say does have an effect on other people. Ephesians 4, verse 15 gives us a very important principle. And Paul writes here that by speaking the truth in love, that we may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ. Verse 16, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. So God calls us into a body because we need to edify each other. It's not just one and one, him and God and us. It's a body, a family together. He wants us to edify each other. He says everybody has a part in this. What we talk about can and should be edifying to each other. You know, what we talk about may be something that really can be encouraging to someone else. In fact, Hebrews 3:13, we already covered this in Bible study some time back, says that we need to, as the New International Version says, encourage one another daily as long as it's called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. You know, how many, don't raise your hands, please, don't want to embarrass anybody or put anybody in the spot. But I'm sure, I hope all of us at one time or another have been in the dumps and felt like, I don't even want to go to church today. And you go to church anyway, and somebody says something, it really, really perks you up. This is what it should be like. Now, on the other hand, somebody can say something really knocks you down, too, and that's not good. That's what we want to avoid. But see, again, the basis is love and serving each other. Our words should be something that encourages other people to hang in there. You know, Satan's after us all week long. This is a spiritual oasis. We come together to fellowship, to share with each other, encourage each other. Not that you have to go up to someone and say, I'm here to encourage you, you know. But, you know, I mean, if we're saying things motivated by love, if we're talking about God's plan, God's word, maybe sermon or an article or, you know, about my father's business or something like that, it can be encouraging people. You don't hear that the rest of the week, most of you. You're out there in the dog-eat-dog world. You just don't have that same opportunity. You're probably familiar with the proverb. Don't turn to it because it's too quick. You won't have time. But just write it down. Proverbs 25:11. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and settings of silver. It's incredible how well you can serve someone else by just saying the right thing in the right way at the right time. By doing some of the other things we've talked about in the sermon here, to show people that you really care about them, that you really love them, that you're really concerned. What is a Christian? I think the Bible clearly shows it's someone who loves God and loves fellow human beings. It's not primarily about doctrine or prophecy or any actions per se. I know people get all hepped up on prophecy. I got an email from somebody, some young person that I'm not sure why I even got it, but I got, was one of the people that was included on it. They're all freaked out because they, on the Facebook, I think it was, they read this thing about the North American Union. Anybody heard about that? Lou Dobbs actually was quoted on CNN. That Bush signed this thing that's going to turn the sovereignty of the United States over. We're going to become one nation, Canada, United States, and Mexico. And the Constitution is going to be scrapped. And we're not going to have any freedoms and blah, blah, and on it went. And this young person says, anybody know about this? Sounds like something we ought to be concerned about. Well, I Googled it, you know, and found a few more things and put an article on it. And it's this New World Order conspiracy again. That's been around for so long. A lot of people freak out. They think this is a big thing. Got everybody on New World Order. There's these two people that are calling all the shots in this world, and they're going to take over the world. We're going to have one world government. I wrote back and said, you know, the only time we're going to have one world government is when Jesus Christ returns. You don't have to worry about this stuff. And this is just another rumor. In fact, I found an article from the Washington Post that said, well, there's a little bit of truth in there, something exaggerated, way out of context, and a bunch of people freaking out. 1.5 million hits on Google. Well, you know, that's not what Christianity is about. You know, all we need to know is that Christ is going to return and replace the governments of the world. I don't care who they are, where they are, or anything else. What I care about is Christ is going to solve the world's problems. That's the only thing that the bottom line as far as prophecy is concerned. Can you believe that I have given a sermon on basic Christianity and have not even mentioned prayer, Bible study, fasting, and meditation? That's not to suggest those aren't important. They are. But if you think all I have to do is get in my prayer, get in my Bible study, fast once in a while, and meditate once in a while, I'm a good Christian, you're sadly mistaken. Those are means to an end. Those are ways to be able to plug in to more of the love of God. They're not an end to themselves. They're not the essence of true Christianity. True Christianity is about relationships with God and fellow human beings based on love. And true love can only come from one source, and that's, of course, from God. And it needs to take root in the hearts of his people and motivate us to serve others. We can conclude here in 1 Corinthians 13, which again says this is really what it's all about. Once again, I'll read this in the New Living Translation. Starting verse 1, Paul says, if I could speak all the languages of earth and of angels, but didn't love others, I would only be a noisy gong or clanging cymbal. So it's not about great spiritual gifts or great abilities or things along that line. If I had the gift of prophecy, and if I understood all of God's secret plans and possessed all knowledge, there's doctrine, and if I had such faith I could move mountains, but didn't love others, I would be nothing. If I gave everything I have to the poor and even sacrificed my body, I could boast about it, but if I didn't love others, I would have gained nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It doesn't demand its own way. It's not irritable and keeps no record of being wronged. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance. Prophecy and speaking in unknown languages and special knowledge will become useless, but love will last forever. Now, our knowledge is partial and incomplete, and even the gift of prophecy reveals only part of the whole picture. But when full understanding comes, these partial things will become useless. Verse 13, three things will last forever: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. And that's what Christianity is all about. How do we show that love? Well, I've shared several Bible principles and instructions in the Bible to help answer that question. I hope I've given you something to talk about and help you become a better Christian by being a more loving person.